Succession number 30493, Reel 12.
Could you explain a bit more about the specific mountain training that you were undergoing on Cyprus?
Well, it's strange, you see. My memory, if I look into it, what do I remember? Nothing, I suppose, is the answer. I mean, I can turn up my diary dealing with our... the earlier diary, not so detailed or extensive as the Italian diaries, or the diaries I kept in Italy. They're rather briefer entries, but every now and again there's quite useful information about different aspects of our life in Cyprus. There's a great deal of information about us, the way we, there again, hard work. We had there are accounts there of us arriving in Cyprus and leaving Cyprus. Now that sounds so simple, doesn't it? But leaving Cyprus after the training, it was involved in all the enormous task of shifting equipment, closing down the camps, getting it to the airport, to the Famagusta harbour, and that whole process of labour and work is described in detail. There was an army of who helped us. I'm not quite sure. To help us with the labour, part of the Indian troops. And anyway, that whole process of movement, and you see, it's not about fighting. There are pages and pages that have nothing to do with fighting, but they're about what a war is about, the impact it makes on the environment, on whole communities, on towns, cities, countries. I mean, Cyprus might well have gone the fate of the other islands in the Mediterranean and been bombed and occupied by the Nazis. I mean, Malta got a cross, didn't it? The Malta Cross for its heroism in defying the endless Nazi bombing. Cyprus was relatively fortunate. There was a good ACAC defence, and the only German aircraft I ever saw was a spy plane, a very light plane, very, very high up. It used to go over the island regularly, perhaps every day. It was beyond that ACAC far, very high up. And I suppose taking photos. And of course, we weren't a big force in Cyprus. There was the 10th Indian Division, and so it meant infantry and guns, but generally not enough to defend them out of the island. So dummy guns, there's a special unit in the army that was very good at producing dummy tanks and dummy guns, and they did it a lot in the Middle East and the desert, but they also did it in Cyprus. So from the air it looked as though Cyprus was defended by about four times as many guns as in fact existed. Deception is, very... The whole book's about that now, of course. The techniques, sort of artists were employed to create this deception of the enemy, so that the photographs would give the wrong impression of our strength, wherever we were. It's on an enormous scale, that sort of a very important part of the war. Like black propaganda, that too, a very important part of the war. And some of the most witty and skillful literary people were employed creating lies to transmit to the enemy in some way, so they thought they were truth. The black propaganda, that's a very interesting side of the war. So, exercises there, I can't really tell you anything, because they would have been hard work again. We've gone up into the... you see, I mean, generally the temperature in Cyprus was hot. I mean, it was sort of warm, hot. It might be cold at night, but it was usually a hot place to be. But up in the mountains, you've got ice and snow. So it was very much like what we met later on in Italy. Very useful background, it must have been. Although, there again, I can't remember it. But we'd go up there and there'd be an exercise and there'd be an enemy to attack. And you spent hours manoeuvring in the mountains on these tracks. I mean, you learn to accommodate your vehicle. I don't remember this, but of course, we would have learned how to manipulate these tractors that pulled the gun and the trailer of ammunition, how to negotiate the worst possible tracks and roads, which of course in Italy disappeared altogether eventually, as I said. You went so far, and there were no places to put your guns. It was so rocky, so inhospitable. This is where the Germans were onto a good thing, you know, the geography of Italy, their best ally. The weather, which turned out to be the worst in Italy's history, plus the geography, those were the two things that saved the Nazi divisions in Italy from extinction until the very, very end, when they were trapped in the Po Valley and the war did come to an end. But we became mountain people, there's no doubt about it. Mountain people. And there in the history today, there's that passage I think I read out somewhere where this military writer says he recognised that the soldiery were from urban society where nature had been tamed. They weren't used to angry nature, to hostile nature. And this is what we began to see. We began to be aware of hostile nature in Cyprus. So we became hardened soldiers. We must have done, you know. You just used to being soaked and frozen and still having to work and having to be without sleep. That's what exercises are about. Without being exhausted and still carrying out your orders. And then at the end of this exercise, you get back tired, weary, exhausted, and the order would go out, spotless guns. You all were polishing up the weaponry and had to be shiny and clean before you turfed into your warm blankets. That's what toughening up is in the army. Well, it was for us anyway. So in the time we arrived in Italy, we were prepared for those bloody awful mountains, which went on and on and on. Occasionally we came out of the mountains into the lower levels of the Adriatic side of Italy, and we did have experience of both kinds of warfare, that on the levels, so to speak. But on the levels, there we are. Another gift to the Germans. They flood. Every dam was blown by the Germans. Whole vast areas would become muddy marshland, trapping the armour, trapping heavy vehicles, bringing the war to a stop. In 1944, that is, in my diary, things came to a stop. And we'd been told that the war would end in 1944. We'd had this massive build-up of artillery somewhere. It was a French general who actually announced that tanks are no good in this war. It's the fighting in the mountains that's going to win this war. So there we are. It was us who did the fighting in the mountains. The infantry did. And we were there to back them up. And we backed them up massively, you know. masses of artillery. And we learned to do it all in that inhospitable territory.
To what extent then did the mountain terrain affect the technical side of what artillery did?
It's funny, you know, I've been trying to recall what happened, you see. This sort of challenge of the diaries led me to a book here which is called Barrage, Guns in Action. Now, this is a very good book on all the different aspects of artillery. And there's an excellent piece here on the 25-pounder gun in a chapter called The Not-So-Soft Underbelly. The Not-So-Soft Underbelly. He says, the principal physical feature of Italy is the mountainous backbone, which throws off ribs in such a fashion that the Allied troops seem to be perpetually doomed to be either climbing a mountain or being shot at by somebody who was already up one. And these mountains produce an interesting technical problem for artillery. Do you want to hear about that, the technical problem? He said that when a gun is first developed, it's taken off and fired day after day after day. And then mathematics were applied and in fact the first computer, he says, arose in the army to measure the testing of guns. Teams of mathematicians working with hand calculators and tables of logarithms. Now that was taken over. The first electrical computer ever built was designed precisely for this task. That's interesting, isn't it? How many people know that? The development of firing and bombing tables for the US Army during World War II was such a daunting task that science was called in to help, and the computer was the result. From this model stemmed all the myriad computers which plague us today. Now, the basic assumption is made that the gun and its target are the same height above sea level. Of course, in real shooting, this rarely occurs, and so a slight correction to the gun sight is made, which compensates for this factor. If the two endpoints of the trajectory differ by a large amount, say more than 1,000 feet, then the carefully computed trajectory of the range table firings is no longer accurate, since gravity and other effects will bend it far from its theoretical shape. But then, he says, the British 25-pounder gun, that's our gun, was provided with 4 propelling charges of varying power. Now this is, you know, this is what we were doing every day. So as to give the gunner a selection of trajectories for his gun. Thus at short range, he could use a powerful charge and get a flat shooting trajectory, or, if a hill intervened, a lower charge and more elevation would let the shell swing up into the air and drop onto the target. Provided the country was no more than usually hilly, these charges had an overlap which allowed the use of any 2 charges out to a considerable range so that one could select the charge best suited to the task in hand. But the Italian mountains threw a spanner into the works. The high charge and flat trajectory would smack into the side of the mountain, while the lower charge and high trajectory would clear the mountain top, but would pass so far over the enemy on the reverse slope, who were the target, they would be quite unharmed, and the shells would drop into the valley behind them. So to provide the gunners with the ability to put the shells where they were wanted, special intermediary charges had to be designed. and produced in short order. These effectively gave half steps between the regular charges and enabled more precise trajectories to drop the shells onto the reverse slopes where they were wanted. These charges were almost entirely used in Italy, were rarely seen in other theatres, and were only ever used again in quantity in the Korean War. There, that sums up the technical side of it pretty well, doesn't it? See, number four on the gun had the responsibility. Number five and six had the responsibility of making sure the order would come down. Charge one, charge two, charge three, supercharge. So you had four levels of propellant, which had to be accurately observed. Otherwise, all the statistics would be useless. But it's highly technical. As you can see, as you hear from that, a tremendous amount of science and mathematics behind that, and the computers helped produce that 25 pounder gun, which was very adaptable. We just got to use that like shaving in the morning, brushing your teeth, firing the gun. Just a job of work.
Were there any sort of aesthetic quality or impact on your life in the mountains? The mountain environment itself.
Sorry, the last half.
Did the mountain environment have any sort of aesthetic impact on life in terms of the scenery?
Yes.
Well,
it's interesting. You see, when I did this theatre talk about post-war British theatre, I was determined, after all, you know, you're not talking for people now, you're talking for generations, I hope. That's why I'm going to this such trouble. I want my voice to be heard 100 years from now. It's marvellous. I can be. It's a little corner of immortality, isn't it, really? As long ago I decided that when you're dead, that's the end. But here, my voice can be heard by some scholar or researcher or some simply curious person generations from now. Well, he wanted, and the theatre talk, he didn't want a list of plays I'd seen, did he? He wanted to know, who is this guy, you know? Post-war? Which war, you know? What was he doing in the war, you know? What was it like after the war? So I managed to work into my my theatre talk, which has gone into the archive, by the way, a lot of information about myself and what it was like to be an ex-soldier, you know, what I'd gone through, what the world had gone through. I managed to get that in somehow, here and there. Because, as I say, I was aware that I was talking to the interviewer as I'm talking to you, but knowing that really you're not so much listening to me, I hope, as this potential listener in the future. I mean, on the other hand, I realise that under this mass of archive material, it may well never ever be heard again. Yes. Now that was an interesting question. Yes. Oh, of course. You see, there's the cultural side of the army. Well, you know, the army isn't out to sort of generate an aestheticism among the troops, but it is trying to entertain them and happen. I mean, I'm sure, at a high level, this business of keeping the troops entertained is a major aspect of their concern. I mean, morale. The top brass know that boredom is a terrible, terrible aspect of warfare. These aching times when there's simply nothing to do. So the ENSA is formed. I'm never sure what it meant, that entertainment, that National Service Association, I don't know. But entertainment, the E stands for entertainment. And the army was pretty good, I have to say. Especially the film unit. But I mean, I mentioned Florence just being up the road, you see, and we could, from the battlefield, and we could take a trip into Florence, and they just opened the cinema there. They'd taken over the main cinema in Florence, and for the first time, I discover that Laurence Olivier's Henry V. Had its first European showing in Florence in 1945, and I saw I knew I'd seen it in Italy. I had no idea that it was the first presentation in Europe of Henry V, which made an enormous impact on me, because they had no. Yes, here's a cultural influence for you. The army providing. Olivier's, they could see the whole. I think the film was back because of its significance, its patriotic elements, you know, which was Olivier played it up beautifully. In time of war, it was a great thing to put to do, and it was a marvellous film. Have you seen it? This is a tremendous. Oh, it's a wonderful film. You can see it over and over again. Lots of Olivier's at his peak. And that the battle scenes are so well done. Oh, unforgettable. And the music. Famous musician did the music for it. And the music stands on its own. I mean, it's played at the proms. We've heard the music for Olivier's Henry V. Is it William Wharton, of course? So William Wharton wrote the music. It's marvellous. Look out for it. Listen to it. Wonderful. So cultural influences, yes, they were there, and I certainly benefited. For instance, one of my favourite tales, which I do remember very well because it was so strange, of all places to see ballet for the first time in your life, can you imagine the army all sitting down to watch a ballet? And they did it in the middle of a desert in Africa, in Egypt. I remember squatting on the sand there with lots of other guys, and then we watched the Polish Ballet Company. How about that? So,
what sort of reception did they get?
Sorry?
What sort of
I think fascination, you know, because they were good. And it was wonderful, you know, the music. I mean, really, real cultural... introduction, you know, to something other than war. Stalin, although he'd been horribly brutal to the Poles, you know, the Katyn massacre, yeah, I think everybody's heard about. He killed off the officer class of the Polish army. But when the war got bad, he allowed General Anders to form an army in Russia and then allow it to go into the Middle East and join us, become part of the Allies' struggle against Hitler in the Middle East and Italy. And the Polish brigade fought. You know, I mean, these men lost everything, you know, their families, their country. And God, they were savage soldiers. They really, when they went into action, and they were at Cassino, you see, they were instrumental, one of the instrumental forces at winning Cassino. That was a terrible, terrible, terrible war, terrible battle. So, when Anders brought his army through into the Middle East, he brought the Ballet Company with him. It's incredible, isn't it? And the Polish Ballet performed for us in the desert in North Africa. Amazing. That's all forgotten, but it's there somewhere in my diary. Now, other cultural things. Well, opera. Now, I'd never seen an opera before, but in Italy, I saw at least three operas. The first was Naples. I had this task of driving an officer. I drove about 200 miles into Naples quite soon after it was liberated. And it was then being... there again, that's all quite well chronicled in my diary. It's massive American presence there, and they were building up these enormous stocks of weapons and equipment in Naples. And I drove this officer in this truck, so I think 200 miles through the mountains into Naples. And we went to some big depot, loaded up. So I don't know. But overnight we stayed overnight. And I thought, well, you know, it's a grand opera house, and so I bought a ticket and saw opera that night. Which I can't remember what. But there was Naples in the middle of this terrible war, still putting on its operas. It's incredible now, looking back. Really, the city was so battered, the poverty, the misery in that city. And there again, the book to read. This is an absolute must. There are very few books I recommend to read about Italy. But this one, Naples 44, by Norman Lewis, it's marvellous to read. Terrific praise from everybody. One goes on reading page after page as if eating cherries. Uncommonly well written, entertaining despite its depressing content, and quite remarkably evocative. Yeah, recommended. If you want to know what life was like, he was intelligence. The subtitle is An Intelligence Officer in the Italian Labyrinth. He had to deal with the mafia. Yeah, who knows about the mafia in Italy? What an important role the mafia played. The Americans trusted the mafia. This is a weird thing, you know. How about putting one of the top mafia bosses from Chicago in charge of supplies in in a major city? Perhaps it was Naples. It's in the hands of the mafia. It's a marvellous story. They're going to talk for hours about the role of the mafia and P2, the independent fascists still working away there. Wonderful stories. Again, I've got a little literature all about it. So, cultural influences. There's the operas. Oh, well, the really marvellous. I saw one in some little backwater town in Italy, Lucia di Lammermoor. And there was this great fat woman playing Lucy. You know, Lucy, you always think of a slim sort of person, don't you? She's a big fat woman. this have got that image still in my head. But the big moment was Venice. Now, this must have been just when we'd liberated Venice and the war had come to an end, and we were allowed leave into Venice. And what a discovery that was. Oh, that is some city, you know, really is. But then, of course, somehow it's extraordinary. Life had gone in that city. I suppose through the general, you know, through hundreds of years, Venice has always had its own life, you know, despite all that was going on the mainland. Anyway, there, the Fenice Theatre, a beautiful theatre, and there they were, Boris Godunov was on. And I was given a week's leave. I was there with a mate, I've forgotten his name. And the two of us, he'd never been to an opera before. I said, come on, come and see this opera. And so we went to the Fenice Theatre, saw this magnificent production. And I mean, half the people in the town were hungry, you know, and yet they went on putting on their operas. And then, of course, I thought, well, the Nazis had been seeing this opera. The theatre had been full of Germans for a couple of years, you know. And here we are now, a new audience in khaki.